Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Once upon a dismal day, Bob's ice cream van looked gloomy and gray. Although he had big ambitions, his socials lacked creative vision.
That bad?
Maybe vamp it up a tad?
I have an idea.
Bob launched Canva and got into gear.
Create the video in the vampire theme and make it the funniest meme.
It went viral. Bob's business, a revival. Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at canva.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Are you caring for an aging loved one? Are you a senior searching for answers? Welcome to Senior Care Live, a program dedicated to you. Providing information, education, and resources for seniors and their caregivers. And now, America's Senior Care Consultant, Steve Kuecker.
Hello and welcome to Senior Care Live. I'm Steve Kuecker, your Senior Care Consultant, and I really appreciate you tuning in. We have an excellent program for you here today. My friend and special guest in studio, Dr. Jeffrey Burns. He's the co-director of the KU Alzheimer's Research Center. And Dr. Burns, welcome back to Senior Care Live.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
All right. And it's been way too long, so we're going to have to do this more frequently. So, been a while. So, all right. So, if you'd like to reach out to Dr. Burns and the phenomenal team at the, again, the KU Alzheimer's Research Center, here's the phone number, 913-588-0555. You could also go online at kualzheimer.org. And let me just say this, if you're not located in the Kansas City area, later on in the program, we'll let you know how to identify local resources available in your area. So just stay tuned, but you're going to, I promise you, you're going to learn a lot today. So Dr. Burns, let's start off with kind of a 101 level question. What is Alzheimer's disease and what actually causes that cognitive disruption?
Yeah, so Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disease that affects memory and planning and organization or executive function. And in the process of Alzheimer's disease, we see cell death in certain areas of the brain. Hmm. And the big question that you're asking is what causes that?
Yeah.
We know that cell death is associated with the buildup of something called amyloid plaques and something called neurofibrillary tangles. So we see those increase in the brain as we see the loss of brain cells.
So there's a physical presence of something that's not supposed to be there.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. We see that buildup. Now, the big argument we have is, do those cause the disease or are they the byproduct of something else causing the disease? And so your question, what's causing it, is still a matter of debate and sort of scientific, questions. And we're trying to get to the root of that. But we know it's a progressive brain disease, and it tends to be seen in older adults.
So that's a chicken and the egg situation.
Yes, exactly.
So let's assume that if the plaques and tangles cause Alzheimer's or cause this disruption in the cell death, et cetera, then the question is, can we then stop the buildup? Or you prevent that in the first place, or maybe decrease the buildup over time. And so, but that may not be it at all. It may be a reverse where it's just a byproduct of it.
That's right. If it's a byproduct of it, then yeah, we may be chasing the wrong target, but that's exactly what we're doing, is we're targeting those proteins that build up and trying to prevent them from building up and seeing, does that, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, but does that impact the patient in a positive way? And still a matter of debate.
Okay. And that's why we're doing all these tests, these clinical trials all over the country.
That's right. Yeah. There's a huge effort all over the country, all over the world.
All over the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. And so here's another one. What is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Because I hear these two terms intermingled and they probably shouldn't be, I would assume.
Yeah. Well, so this I'm glad you're starting with this question because this is the number one question that we get is what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? And dementia is a really broad umbrella term that simply means, you know, someone has cognitive issues or memory and thinking issues that are interfering with their daily function, interfering with their ability to do the things they've always done. So it's a syndrome that is just, you know, that. Now, the next question that we ask is, what's the cause of that dementia?
Yeah.
And that's where Alzheimer's comes in. It's the number one cause of dementia. So it's actually a specific cause of dementia and the number one cause, accounting for about two-thirds of all dementia. So that's why we often use the terms, you know, synonymously.
Okay.
And confuse people, but Alzheimer's is a type of dementia.
Okay, and that's how I've heard it explained, I think, from you and in several of the presentations that I've sat in on. It's a type of dementia.
That's right.
And that's kind of an easy way to look at that.
To think of it, yeah. So we first, you know, we want to recognize when there's dementia, when somebody's having these kind of cognitive issues, and then we want to ask what's the cause, and we have a process for diagnosing it. But what we're doing in that process is predicting whether or not somebody has amyloid plaques and tangles in their brain that's associated with their dementia. And that's the definition of Alzheimer's, the plaques and tangles that we were just talking about.
And if you don't have the plaques and tangles, then it's probably some other form of dementia.
That's right.
Which is my next question. How many forms are there? I've read things where like 70 or 75 forms of dementia. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but how many forms are there now?
There are a lot. I can't put a number on it, but there's dozens.
Okay.
There's actually, you know, four that are, you know, the most common. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's, as we've talked about, is number one. There's another form called dementia with Lewy bodies, which looks a lot like Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
And Alzheimer's, kind of intermixed. There's vascular dementia or stroke-related dementia where people have strokes or vascular injury that leads to cognitive issues that interfere with daily function. And then there's something called frontotemporal dementia where we see a lot of social and behavior and language problems based on, you know, where in the brain we're seeing the degeneration occur. Mm. And so those are kind of the big four that we think a lot about and see a lot of patients with, but Alzheimer's by far dominates, as the number one cause of dementia.
Okay, and what is the average age of someone with Alzheimer's disease?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or maybe there's a range.
There's a big range. I'd probably say the average age is, you know, between 70 and 75.
Okay.
But we, of course, have a big range. We can see early onset. We can see late onset.
So what so can you have Alzheimer's disease at a younger age? And if so, you talked about early onset. You know, how young are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, in certain forms or some genetic forms, which are really rare, but where it runs in the family, we may see the onset in the 40s. I've seen one patient in his late 30s develop Alzheimer's. It's really rare, and I've heard of a report of one patient at the age of 29 being diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Oh, now, my gosh.
Incredibly rare, but, you know, that tells you it can occur early. In my clinic where I see patients, I often see people in their 50s, and so we can see it young. We consider that early onset under the age of 65. And then we also see late onset. So we see people in their 90s develop it.
Wow.
Now, one of the things we've learned and suspect is that they may be different. We call them both Alzheimer's, the early onset forms and the late onset form. They may actually be different diseases. We when we look at the brain under the microscope, there's some important differences. People with late onset Alzheimer's have a little bit fewer of the plaques and tangles, and they have more other pathologies, things like vascular changes that are more prominent. And so we do study and think about early onset versus late onset, which is why you'll hear us often talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so I help families and individuals find the right senior care community. The youngest client that I've ever worked with, she was, I think, 48 and she was diagnosed in 49 when we helped her husband with placement. And I think hers was just really rapidly declining. Does early onset Alzheimer's, is there a quicker decline on that, or is that just very individualized?
Well, yeah, everything's individualized, but okay. I'd say on average, early onset moves more quickly than late onset, and that's something we expect, but it's not always true. But yeah, the relationship between the speed with which somebody declines can be predicted by age of onset to some degree. So earlier onset, younger onset tends to be a more sort of aggressive mm-hmm. course versus the late onset, which tends to move a little bit slower.
Okay. And unfortunately, my wife's best friend's mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I think about 49 or 50.
Wow.
And that just devastated her entire family.
Yep.
They felt like they were robbed of a lot of good years. So it's a serious disease. It's just impacts so many people. As far as statistics, what are some of the numbers of statistics as far as, you know, the number of people with Alzheimer's today and then maybe projected into the future? Because I know the numbers are disturbingly large.
Yeah, they are. And we need to, and that's why we're doing so much to try to fight this disease. So it's about 6 million Americans who have Alzheimer's right now.
Okay.
I think the better way to think of it is about 1 in 9 people over the age of 65 have it, which is amazing. But if you move to the 85 and older, it's about 1 in 3 people over the age of 85.
Okay.
And so as you get older, it is just increasingly more common and your risk goes up as you get older and move into these older age groups.
Do we have any idea why these numbers seem to be exploding? Just the numbers seem to get larger every year.
Yeah, the primary driver of that is we have an aging population, which is a good thing. We're living longer,
sure,
healthier lives, and because the sheer number of people in that older age group, 85 and older, 65 and older, is going up, we're seeing, along with it, an increase in the number of people with Alzheimer's.
And we go 1 in 9 to 1 in 3.
Yep.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah.
So the good news, we're living longer. The bad news is Alzheimer's is more and more prevalent as we age. So
exactly.
All right. We'll have more with Dr. Burns coming up next. But first, the Senior Care Live question of the week. Alzheimer's disease is different than dementia. Is that statement true or false? What do you think?
You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. For more information, visit SeniorCareLive.com. We'll have more with Steve coming up next.
Welcome back. You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. For more information, go to SeniorCareLive.com. All right, back to the Senior Care Live question of the week. Alzheimer's disease is different than dementia. Is that statement true or false? And the answer is... false. The answer is false. And Dr. Burns, why is that false?
Well, it's false because Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. It's actually a form of dementia. So yes, it is false because of that.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Excellent. We're here with Dr. Jeffrey Burns. He's the co-director of the KU Alzheimer's Resource Center. You can reach out to Dr. Burns and the phenomenal team at the KU Alzheimer's Research Center at 913-588-0555. Or you can go online at KUAlzheimer.org. And don't forget, if you're not located in the Kansas City metro area, later on in the program, we'll let you know how to identify local resources available in your area. All right. So, Dr. Burns, this is a question that a lot of folks may have. How are Alzheimer's patients being affected by COVID-19, if at all?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are affected, and they've been sort of disproportionately affected by COVID-19 because they're a vulnerable group, for one. So they're much more vulnerable to COVID-19. And then the other is they tend to be in nursing facilities, mm-hmm. So the impact, one, the disease spreads pretty quickly when you're in a facility,
yeah.
And so we know that happened early, especially in the pandemic. But the response to COVID-19, having to basically, you know, shut things down or limit visitors, really had an impact in terms of the social isolation on these patients. And we know social interactions and engagement with others is important for patients. I know that we see it. I know our social workers saw it, a big increase in sort of psychosocial support needs for these patients who are isolated and symptoms of depression worsened and things like that. So, yeah, COVID-19, you know, specifically, does it have an impact in a different way on the patient than what we understand? No. They're just a little, they're more vulnerable as a group. And then that, you know, those sort of social aspects are very important in the Alzheimer's patient group.
And that social isolation just really caused the damage. So that's more, like you said, you know, psychosocial versus medical. So obviously people who are older, and so they're generally in that category, but, you know, with COPD or CHF, diabetic, obesity, all of those things medically put you at more risk. But with Alzheimer's and dementia patients in assisted living and long-term care, just that isolation, I've just heard it reported over and over that they just felt like their decline really accelerated because of that social isolation, and that was a really negative effect of that. So
Yeah, very much.
So let's move on to the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. So there are a lot of people out there who say, you know, I've noticed that my mom or my dad or myself, you know, I haven't been quite as sharp as I used to be and getting a little forgetful. You know, I lost my key. I misplaced my keys the other day. Do I have Alzheimer's? So I think some people may have something to worry about and some folks don't have anything to worry about. So how, what are the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, so the sort of typical early signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's are, you know, new problems, stress that, in memory, so short-term memory, and then in what we call executive function, which is planning and organizing. And so with respect to memory, what we see is, again, new issues for an individual, not that I've always misplaced my car keys my cell phone or my glasses, but now I'm, you know, they may be losing tax documents when they were obsessed about that before, or repeating themselves is a really strong sign of the short-term memory. Asking the same question over and over, like they haven't heard the answer, or telling the same story over and over. Not the typical way. Maybe somebody likes to repeat stories, but now they're repeating themselves in a new way. Those are really strong signs of the short-term memory problems that we see early in Alzheimer's. And then on the organizing, planning, the sort of executive function, it's maybe following a recipe, make it basically judgment and problem solving skills, try to sort of sort through complicated things and make a big decision can become more problematic. So those are the kinds of things. They can be pretty subtle, but they're for that individual, they're new. And they're sort of noticeable, and they're beginning to interfere with that person's ability to do their usual things.
That's really, really helpful. Just the fact that you said this is something that is new. It's not normal for this person. And so that's when you should perk up and start paying attention to that.
That's right.
Okay. So my son, one of my boys, we have triplet boys, and one of them's 20, and he said, "Hey, Dad, I lost my keys." He was out fishing on this rocky bank of a lake. So I'm out here with my metal detector. We're out there for an hour. We were eaten alive by mosquitoes and, you know, all the stuff. Never found it. He goes fishing the next week, and he goes, "Dad, you're gonna be mad at me. My key was in the tackle box." So he doesn't have Alzheimer's. He's just being a blockhead 20-year-old boy.
That's right. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's really good to know. So I could do is laugh at that one. I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. So anyway, so if you suspect that you may have Alzheimer's disease, or just like you just so clearly said, some of these new issues and how it impacts your function and your executive, you know, thought and all of those sort of things, what should you do, and what is your next step? What would you recommend your next step if you suspect you might have the very early signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I think, the right first step would be to talk to your doctor. Run it by them and see what they think, and hopefully they take you seriously. And what they should consider doing is a little bit of testing. They might do it right there in the clinic. And if they are worried after seeing that testing, they would consider doing a brain scan to make sure they're not, you know, something like a stroke or something else hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And maybe some lab work. But I think you start by bringing it up with your doctor. And just one other thing is if you're worried about yourself, you might check with somebody who knows you really well.
Ah.
Have they noticed any changes? And hopefully they can be real honest with you. Have they noticed any changes? And I think one of the things we do in our clinic is we sit down with a loved one, you know, the spouse or a child, and we really work hard to make sure somebody comes with them because we like to get that sort of perspective from the family because that perspective is what can tell us, have they changed? Are we dealing with a new onset of a problem, you know, where somebody's having some problems that they didn't have 2 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah. And that person's probably going to tell the truth or maybe fill in some of the gaps or fill in some of the details that the actual patient or potential patient might miss.
May not know.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Years and years ago, right when I first started senior care consulting, I worked with a super nice lady, and she and her mom, every Christmas, they made cookies. And so she came back from Denver to Kansas City, worked with her mom, hands her a cup, said, "Mom, I need a cup of sugar." And she turns around, and she's tending to getting the, all the stuff together. She turned around, and her mom was just looking at the cup.
Yeah.
And she's and she said, "It took my breath away because I realized at that second, my mom didn't know what to do with the cup." And that's her first giant sign that mom had a problem.
Right.
So, all right, do not go away. We have so much more with Dr. Burns, co-director of the KU Alzheimer's Research Center. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. Have a question? Visit SeniorCareLive.com. Stick around. We'll have more with Steve coming up next.
Welcome back. You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. For podcasts of the program, just visit Senior Care Live, that's L-I-V-E, SeniorCareLive.com, or wherever you get your podcast. My special guest in studio today, Dr. Jeffrey Burns, co-director of the KU Alzheimer's Research Center. You can reach Dr. Burns and the phenomenal team at the KU Alzheimer's Research Center at 913-588-0555 or visit online at KUAlzheimer.org. And Dr. Burns, again, it is so great to have you here today. And I know your schedule is jam-packed, so I just want to thank you again for making time for us today on the program.
Well, thanks for the invite.
All right. So can Alzheimer's disease be accurately diagnosed? And just a minute ago, you talked about maybe a simple test that your doctor can run in the office and maybe talk about how, you know, years ago, it could only be diagnosed after a person had died, and then you had to inspect the brain. But now I think we've made some pretty phenomenal advances on that.
Yeah, we are. We're making very rapid advances in the area of diagnosis. You know, a lot of that is on the research side, though, still.
Okay.
And, you know, the way we typically diagnose is still get a history, get the story, and establish that there's been these, you know, the type of memory changes and changes and organizing and planning and all that go along with it. And then we do, it's very important to think about, all right, what could be causing this? And when we diagnose Alzheimer's, a lot of what we're doing is ruling out other potential causes.
Ah.
So making sure somebody hasn't had a stroke by getting an MRI scan, doesn't have a tumor in their brain by getting an MRI scan. We look at some lab work. And, you know, to rule out low thyroid or low B12, which can, both of those can cause memory issues.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and sort of working through, you know, a process where we're ruling out some of the more common things that can influence memory. And so the diagnosis is really, really dependent currently on the story, the history. Sort of a low-tech diagnosis is still the predominant way. But we can do a whole lot more now. And we're starting to do that. It's really entering into clinical practice. And we can now detect whether or not somebody has amyloid plaques or the tangles in their brain using some really fancy scans, which aren't widely used because they're so expensive. We can also do spinal fluid analysis, which means and requires somebody to have a lumbar puncture, which people don't love that. It's pretty straightforward, relatively simple procedure, but it's still invasive, so people don't love to do that.
Right.
And then on the horizon, and actually it's here on the research side, it's coming on the in the clinics, in you know, where you'll eventually be able to sit down with your doctor. And a blood test will really help guide the diagnosis. I'm not sure it's going to totally replace or make the diagnosis, but a blood test that tells us whether or not, or indicates to some degree, whether or not somebody has amyloid in their brain, those types of tests are really coming soon. We think in the next 1 to 2 years we'll have those to be sort of augmenting what we learned from the history and our testing. And provide us with, you know, some biological information on what might be going on in the brain.
See, and I had heard about this blood test, and I wasn't sure if that was even available. So it's on the research side, and it sounds pretty promising as far as a indicating the possibility, I guess. Of
having it. Exactly. And we're doing it's something we've been doing for a few years.
Yeah.
We're investigating it. We're beginning to use it on the research side. But there's a much bigger sort of hurdle to overcome before we start using it on the clinic side, using it in a way that will guide our treatments and our, you know, our diagnoses and prognoses. We're just not quite there yet.
Okay.
But it's coming.
Okay. That's very encouraging. And then at the same time, I don't know if I want to know.
Right.
And then all of these DNA, you know, genealogy, ancestry.com, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that plays any, has a place in this diagnosis.
It does. Does somebody want to know? And, you know, if somebody has memory problems, you know, and we were trying to get to the bottom of it, that's one question, you know, using these tests.
Yeah.
But the one you're bringing up is somebody without memory problems.
Yeah.
If we can learn something about risk or about predicting what's to come, we need to be really careful in how we use that information.
Yeah.
That's something we've studied, is how do we disclose it in a responsible way, and how do we do it, you know, in a way that, you know, is sort of actionable. The last thing we want to do is create a bunch of angst in someone there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those types of tests are also coming, you know, where we can, you know, determine how high a risk somebody's at of developing it. But what we need to make that very powerful is interventions, ways that we can reduce the risk for an individual. So what are we going to do with that information? And so we're actually working furiously on both fronts. Yeah. Can we diagnose early? And what we're talking about now is, can we diagnose before the onset of any memory problems?
Maybe we can delay the onset potentially.
So if we can diagnose before the onset of memory problems, then it's what do we do to delay that onset or hopefully put it off forever by intervening with drugs or lifestyle factors? And that's exactly where the field's headed.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. That makes sense. So that leads me to my next question. How can you reduce your risk for Alzheimer's disease?
Well,
is there anything that just all of us can do to just lower that risk?
Yeah. So, and that's a perfect question, because we think yes, the answer is yes. We're working really hard to prove it in a variety of ways. But what do we recommend for people now? The most evidence out there suggests that staying active physically and mentally is important. And so physical exercise, we believe is a way to reduce one's long-term risk. So get out and walk every day.
Yeah.
30 minutes a day, at least, you know, 5 days a week, we think is, you know, the right amount, but you don't have to get to that to have a benefit. If you just get out a couple times a week, we think that's also having an impact. So don't let that threshold scare you.
Sure.
But exercise, eating right, we think is important, and we think probably the most data exists to support the Mediterranean diet in terms of brain health. And so that's a healthy diet where you're really not restricting how much you eat, but you're shifting your pattern from sort of the typical Western diet to one where we have more fish, more fruits and vegetables, berries, nuts, and healthy fats like olive oil.
Yeah.
So Mediterranean diet, good sleep we think is really important, and there's links between that we've learned really in the last decade, links between poor sleep and things like amyloid in
the
brain.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So we think, you know, sleeping well, good sleep hygiene, going to bed at the same time, getting up at the same time is important. And then, you know, reducing stress and social engagement and not getting isolated, things like that, which we've talked a little bit about. And so all these things add up to good, you know, good brain health practices. And you know, this is what exactly the kind of thing we're working on, these things, trying to understand how they relate to brain health, and then try to package them and get people to do them more. And those are the you know, one big angle of what the KU Alzheimer's Disease Research Center is working on.
Okay, and so one thing that popped into my head, just good sleep. So this is to all the folks out there with sleep apnea, and they're like, oh, I'm not going to deal with the CPAP. Well, guess what? You need to go get the CPAP because, first of all, you reduce a very high risk of atrial fibrillation. By the way, that could lead to a heart attack or a stroke. So there's one. Number two, now we just learned that you can decrease your risk of Alzheimer's. So quit kicking that can down the road and go get your CPAP.
Yeah, good point. Thank you for making that.
Get that.
That's something we always think about with every patient with memory issues is kind of screen for sleep, the possibility of sleep apnea. If you got it, you really want to be working on taking care of it or treating it. And some people just cannot tolerate the CPAP.
Yep.
But
yep.
Do your best because it's good for your brain.
And I remember what you told me, and it's been a while back, but you said sitting is the new smoking.
Yeah.
So that sedentary, just not lack of movement, I guess.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. Yep.
Sitting is the new smoking. I love that phrase.
Yeah.
And it just reminds us that, just kind of sitting around. And a lot of us work jobs where we're just sitting in front of the computer, and I'm one of them. And so you really need to try to break up your day and get some steps in and then get that exercise in too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how is Alzheimer's disease being treated today?
Well, we do have two drugs that we use routinely, two classes. And so, you know, I think it's important to think of Alzheimer's as treatable. We can't cure it, but the drugs that we've been using now for a good 20 to 30 years are important, and they help slow the decline. And the drugs are donepezil or Aricept, the brand name, and then memantine or Namenda.
Okay.
And then there's a couple cousins of Aricept as well. So, but those two drugs together we use in patients with moderate Alzheimer's. And in the earliest stages of Alzheimer's, we use the donepezil alone.
Okay.
That's the typical treatment for people with Alzheimer's.
And are those two drugs, or one or the other, or both, are they pretty effective?
Yeah, well, that's what we argue about. People don't bounce back from the drugs.
Sure. You just slow the decline.
Slow the decline.
Yeah.
Which is not the most, you know, compelling argument, and we're working really hard to do more. But nonetheless, they're important drugs that we need to take advantage of.
Excellent, excellent. And if you're not located in the Kansas City area, coming up next, we'll let you know how to identify local resources available in your area.
You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. To contact Steve or a guest on his show, visit SeniorCareLive.com. We'll have more coming up.
Welcome back. You're listening to Senior Care Live on the Senior Care Broadcasting Network. Have a question? Visit SeniorCareLive.com. Today, our special guest in studio, Dr. Jeffrey Burns. He's the co-director of the KU Alzheimer's Research Center. You can reach out to Dr. Burns and the phenomenal team at the KU Alzheimer's Research Center. Here's the phone number. Write it down. It's 913-588-0555, or you can visit online at KUAlzheimer.org. And Dr. Burns, let's talk about where Alzheimer's treatment is headed, and can you discuss what future treatments might look like?
Yeah, so we just talked about the two drugs that have been around for a while, and they're important. Just last year, a brand new drug was approved for Alzheimer's disease, and it was the first drug in 18 years to be approved.
Gosh. Wow.
And we've been working really hard this last 18 years, and so that drug's called Aduhelm.
Okay.
And you know, it's an important step. We're not sure it's necessarily in the right direction. And if you've heard about this drug, you've probably seen along with it that there's a lot of controversy.
Okay.
So the drug was approved in a sort of limited way by the FDA based on its ability to actually remove amyloid from the brain.
Oh, wow.
So it's an infusion drug. It's very expensive. It comes with a little bit of risk that is, you know, could be serious. And it actually works really well to remove amyloid from the brain. But the big question that we haven't proven definitively is how big an impact does that have on the patient? Does the patient get better? Does the patient do better over time? And that is what we're still debating. There's some evidence that they might do a little bit better over time, but there's also some evidence that they may not get any better over time. And so that's what we're still debating. That's why it's not being widely used. And in fact, we're basically using it only in the setting of research currently right now. Okay. And Medicare has agreed to pay for it, but only when we're using it in the setting of a research study. So we're in a transition period where, you know, the good news is, hey, we made a big advance. We've got a new drug. But, you know, the bad news is it's not quite proven and we're not really using it widely because we need more data. We need more evidence that it's impactful.
And that's really interesting because that gets back to that chicken and the egg. So if you remove the amyloid, does that cure Alzheimer's or does it have any impact at all? I think that will tend to start to answer. I don't think if it definitively answers that question, but I think that puts you on the road to answering that question.
Oh, absolutely. And this is, we've been working for decades to test this idea.
Yeah.
And now we've really tested it in a lot of different ways. And it you know, at best, it may slow the disease, but it's not a cure. And that was something 5 years ago we were hopeful that maybe this is a cure.
Okay.
I think this may be a part of the cure in the future. We're going to figure that out in the next couple of years. But it's not the, you know, magic bullet, but it may be part of sort of a cocktail approach where we need to go after this disease from different angles. And this may be one of the important angles going after amyloid.
And just like with AIDS, treatment of AIDS, that used to be a guaranteed death sentence. And now it's not because you have a cocktail of different medications and you can live a very long life. And hopefully we can get to that point with Alzheimer's. If we can't completely cure it, maybe we can help a person live with that and not be so debilitated.
Exactly.
So, okay. And so, Dr. Burns, I know that you and the team at the KU Alzheimer's Research Center conduct studies every single day. I would like to put out a call to action to all of our listeners participating in Alzheimer's studies and clinical trials. And KU Alzheimer's Disease Center or Research Center is one of 33 certified test locations or trial locations. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're one of the National Institute of Aging sort of designated Alzheimer's disease research centers.
Okay.
And yes, there's 33 in the country.
Okay. And so if some of our listeners, obviously thousands of our listeners are outside of the Kansas City metro area, where can they go to basically, you know, get information on Alzheimer's locally and then maybe look into participating in some of these trials?
Well, great. I'm so glad you're emphasizing this because, yeah, fighting Alzheimer's is about, you know, the community and the community being a part of these efforts. It's not just scientists in labs. We need you. We need you to be on our team.
We need volunteers.
We need volunteers.
Yeah.
And that's the only way we can move the field forward. And so this is so important. And really, that slows us down more than anything else, is finding people to participate in these trials. And so I'd recommend, you know, look and see, is there a NIA, National Institute of Aging, Alzheimer's Disease Research Center in your area? There's 33 around the country. There's other places that are doing research as well. There's doctor's offices that might be doing Alzheimer's research. And, you know, to sort of figure that out, a good place to start is the Alzheimer's Association.
Okay.
They have great resources online, and you could call at one of their offices, and they could potentially point you in the right direction.
And they have local chapters all around the country.
They do, yep. So you could get information from them. They also have a trial match program, something called Alzheimer's Association Trial Match Program. So if you're really interested in research, you could check that out. And then if you want to do your own homework, I think going to clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, clinicaltrials.gov is a good place to start because every clinical trial is registered in that database and you can search it and you can see where things are happening and kind of what stage the trials are in. And so there's a lot of information there if you want to, you know, sort of dig around and do your homework.
Okay. And do we have enough diversity in trial participants?
Oh, so the short answer is no.
No.
And
we're
working really hard and we're seeing a big increase in diversity in trials because of these efforts. But we need people from all walks of life, from all races and cultures. And
sure.
And so, you know, it's so important. And the last thing we want is a new drug that only treats, you know, white men.
A certain group. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we need drugs and we need to prove that they're effective and very diverse. Yep, for everybody.
And so I remember a lot of stuff that you tell me. So, and one of the things that it caught me off guard a little bit, and then it made total sense. You said, you know, every trial that fails, we're not upset about that. We consider that a win because now we know what doesn't work, and then that will guide us to our next step. And so we consider that important or valuable.
Yeah, they're the building blocks. Failure is the building blocks for, you know, success. And it hurts. It's painful. These trials, we put sometimes decades into them of our lives, and more often than not, they quote unquote fail. But that we learn from that, and it helps us sort of guide the future, our future efforts. And so even if you're participating in a trial where we learned the drug didn't work, you're still helping move the field forward.
Absolutely. And one thing that you had mentioned, again, is that someone in one of these trials will be successful, and you will have participated in curing Alzheimer's disease. That just gave me goosebumps saying that.
That's right. So the first patient cured of Alzheimer's is going to be in a clinical trial. That's where it's going to happen. And that's the only place it can happen. So we don't, you know, the trials and the drugs we're testing, we don't know if they work. We don't know if they're the cure, but that's how we figure it out.
And as far as just concluding the program here today, and again, I sure appreciate you coming in today. Do you think there will be a cure for Alzheimer's disease in my lifetime, maybe in the next 20, 25, 30 years?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. Actually, I don't think it's a question of if. I think it's a question of when.
Of when, yeah.
Yep. And it's going to be an approach that it's probably not, you know, it's not a single magic bullet. It's going to be an approach where we're going after the disease and reducing risk from multiple angles.
That makes sense. That makes so much sense. Thank you so much for being here today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you and all the great information you've shared with our listeners.
Oh, thank you for the invite. It's great to be here.
All right. I'm your host, Steve Kuecker, and I wish you grace and peace. May God bless you and your family on this day and always. Join me next week right here on Senior Care Live.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
There's artificial intelligence, then there's apartmental intelligence. Yep, it's a thing. Apartments.com knows how to find the exact place you have in mind. Want a 3-bedroom condo in a walkable downtown? Done. Or that single family home with a yard and a quiet neighborhood? Easy. With over 1 million rental listings, plus search tools that make moving simple, their apartmental intelligence can get you a place that gets you. Visit apartments.com, the place to find a place.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab 3 of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
FanDuel's getting you ready for the NFL season with an offer you won't want to miss. New customers can bet just $5 and get $300 in bonus bets if you win. That's right, pick a bet $5, and if it wins, you'll unlock $300 in bonus bets to use all across the app. You can build parlays, bet player props, ride the live lines, whatever your style, FanDuel has you covered. The NFL season's almost here. The only question is, are you ready to play? Visit FanDuel.com/sportsfan to download the FanDuel app today and get started.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.